Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, this is the Burke Allen Show on WAMS with Billboard Magazine award-winning broadcaster Burke Allen. Interesting guests, intriguing topics, and your phone calls at 718-506-1944. The Burke Allen Show is a presentation of Allen Media Strategies, online at allenmediastrategies.com. Now, celebrating his third decade behind the mic, here's Burke Allen.
Thanks so much for listening. It's a sunny, beautiful day here in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., so we'll crack open the skyline of our broadcast studio and welcome in Renata DeBlaise. Her new audiobook is called With Stars in My Eyes, and it's a very reverent tribute to a gentleman who influenced her as a young lady, the phenomenal jazz musician Billy Taylor. And Renata was right there in the middle of things with Billy Taylor, Duke Ellington, and the amazing civil unrest that she saw firsthand in the turbulent late 60s in New York City. Renata DeBlaise, welcome to the Burke Allen Program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Burke. And it's so good to have you take the time to talk to me and help me promote this magnificent ebook and audio. And I'd love to talk a little bit about the history. I was a graduate student at Rutgers University in the late 60s, and I think the vocation just absolutely knocked me out. It was a lovely roommate that I had by the name of Priscilla Gang. She was getting a master's degree in economics. One night told me, let's go listen to some fabulous jazz. So she took me to what was an entirely segregated neighborhood in New Brunswick called to a club called The Sportsman, and there I met some wonderful, wonderful musicians playing beautiful jazz and popular music, and I was told that because of racial discrimination, they couldn't make it in New York. They just couldn't get beyond playing in these third-rate places, and it really bothered me very much. There I was, a middle-class white woman studying for a doctor's degree, living in a beautiful apartment called the Colony House, like 5 minutes away, and this is truly, in President Kennedy's words, going into these segregated slums, the other America. And on subsequent occasions, we would go into the neighborhoods, and we would see beautiful, beautiful little children, skin colors ranging from black to tan to beige, playing in the street with really not too many people caring about them. Well, that's when I knew right then the segregation is a terrible, terrible blemish on with the nation's soul. Even though I was very young and as a student, I had to do my part. So I started trying to get concert dates for these musicians to no avail because of discrimination. The reply from Rutgers and to some of these New York impresarios was absolutely negative. And then I decided I no longer wanted to pursue a PhD. You know, sometimes people's lives are just involved in these PhD programs for several years. And I was very fortunate to move to New York in 68 or 69, hired my top administrative assistant. This is like a young woman who had hardly ever worked except in her father's business in upstate New York, who was very much protected because they were well-to-do people. Hired as an administrative assistant, bilingual secretary to Julian Duhar at Simon & Schuster. And just before that, because Rutgers directs the Rutgers Institute of Jazz Studies, I met one of the top directors there, Mr. Charles Nanry, who invited me to attend a jazz session at the famed Five Spot Club. These are all, you know, historic places in New York. And then in 67, I'm going back a couple years, I went to New York to attend one of the jazz concerts at the Five Spot and had read that Billy Taylor was playing at the Hickory House, is another beautiful historic club in New York. I went over with a friend of mine, a graduate from psychology, and as soon as we went into the club, I ordered a drink. Mr. Taylor starts to play at the beautiful, beautiful piano bar. By the way, this was a place frequented by these huge stars. Mary McPartland played there. Duke Ellington played there. He visited. He'd go to have dinner. Thelonious Monk, many, many others. And I had no idea that evening I would even be able to get near Billy Taylor. The only thing I knew about him, he has a magnificent reputation, a very handsome man, and I'd seen him on television lecturing about these great jazz stars, just the way Leonard Bernstein would sit and talk to you with tremendous reverence in his young people's concerts. So I guess it was like an immediate attraction to something very, very nice. Mr. Taylor notices me as he plays the piano, and first thing, a few minutes later, there's a break, and he sits down and wants to know all about my background. And I was not like nervous in any way. This is a woman, like, I was like late 20s because I was studying for a doctor's degree, but I looked like 9 or 10 years younger. And my first reply when he came first question to him when he came over to sit next to me was, Mr. Taylor, would you love to give a concert at Rutgers University because I have connections there? I know the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies. And he was very, very surprised, first of all, that I wasn't afraid to talk to him. Second, Burke, I did not see racial differences. This is 1967, 68. The woman I was with, the graduate student, was absolutely tongue-tied. She said she's not comfortable talking to African-American people, mainly in the presence of a world-famous musician. She just couldn't talk at all. So I asked if he'd like to give a concert at Rutgers, and he said, yes, he would. I said, well, you know how the situation is at Rutgers? They have stellar people running the Institute of Jazz Studies, and it's Julius Bloom, who was the manager at that time of Carnegie Hall, and he was in charge of what was creating the roster for Rutgers. In other words, the musicians would be invited to play at Rutgers to give jazz concerts in the auditorium, and then they'd also play at Carnegie Hall. So this was a very, very plus thing for Mr. Taylor, very, very much impressed with me. And it's just like almost immediately I began doing work for him on a volunteer basis, because at that time, like, rock music was sort of taking over, and jazz wasn't given the respect that it could. And on my own, I would just write letters, trying to get him beautiful dates, and I guess he would work with his manager about that. But what impressed me so much, Burke, was going into these clubs, which in Billy Taylor's obituary, last December 20th, when he passed away, he commented, he's an artist, a jazz artist can spend 8 hours a day practicing, going to play in these clubs. These people are drunk, and maybe they might listen to him for about 5 or 10 minutes. So I just took it on my own to go to visit with him. At the clubs he played at would be the Hickory House, the Top of the Gate. There weren't too many top clubs then. And so I was just impressed the callousness of the people. They would come and they would get drunk and laugh and shout, the total lack of respect for him. And when people listen to the audio, I would say jazz deserves to be played in concert halls. It's America's only true art form. I'm going to have to do something about it. So amazingly, in the meantime, as I said, I did a lot of charity work in my life. I kept it in publishing, wanting to be an editor, and I just took it on my own because I have wonderful writing ability to sit at a typewriter. This is like between mid-1970 and March 1972 to write these beautiful letters to concert hall directors, symphony hall directors, directors of cultural centers, including Lincoln Center, and just really take these people to task. You have jazz series for all types of music, pop music, Frank Sinatra's music, Aaron Copland's music, Leonard Bernstein's music, everything. But when it comes to jazz, these people are subjected to playing in these third-rate places or nothing but the village. And over a period of time, I use Musical America, that's a Billboard publication that lists all of these names, I got loads of very, very favorable replies, and I was able to help establish series, you know, throughout the United States. And in the midst of all of this, there I am busy going to work every day at Simon & Schuster. This is the most touching part of the audio. It's chapter 5. It's April 29th, 1970, and I just wake up in my Upper East Side apartment where I'd seen the very handsome Shakespearean type of mayor, John Lindsay, go to work in the morning, come back at night to Gracie Mansion to live. And there's terrible, terrible segregation in New York. But anyways, April 29th is Duke Ellington's birthday, and it was 1970, which would have marked his 71st birthday. And I had known that the year before, President Richard Nixon was the first American president to truly honor Duke with a celebration entirely in honor of his birthday, 70th birthday at the White House. And it impressed me so much. And I'd seen so much of Duke on television and reading about him in the newspaper, performing all the sacred concerts. So I decided on April 29th, 1970, that his birthday gift from me and from the president of Simon & Schuster, Michael Shimkin, whose father is just a legend in the world of publishing and commerce, Duke Ellington's birthday gift from me is to be given permission, just in carte blanche, to publish absolutely anything he wants. His music, short reminiscences, a complete memoirs, textbooks about beautiful growing up in the nation's capital, textbooks about little children, so little African-American children can be brought into a beautiful, harmonious society. And I presented this proposal to Mr. Shimkin. Remember, it was only like a secretary, a glorified secretary, been there for a few months, and it was in the afternoon of April 29th, Mr. Shimkin comes into my into my office to see me and to see my boss, a very handsome man, about 5'8", beautiful red hair. This was truly a prince, born into a family similar to the Kennedys. He didn't have to work, but he himself had the title of vice president of Simon & Schuster. And he had mentioned to me before, he was very impressed that I knew Billy Taylor. I used to get dates for him. And here is this young woman, late 20s, running over to Lincoln Center to get a date for this, you know, this huge star. He was very impressed by that. But my comment on April 29th, 1970 was, this is Mr. Ellington's 71st birthday, Mr. Shankman. What have we ever done to show our appreciation for his tremendous contribution to American music? Wouldn't it be nice to have him write memoirs or any type of book that he would like? And I thought I was going to get the typical standard reply, well, our publishing plans don't include memoirs of black jazz musicians. I thought it was going to be something like that, but immediately was, well, Renata, you know, this man has lots of girlfriends. And my reply is, I know he's a very handsome man, that he's pursued by women all over the world, the way Billy Taylor had the same type of charm, and I'm sure that lots and lots of women loved writing letters and whatever, pursuing him. You know, these are people in the limelight, that just the way we have Hollywood today. So surprisingly, Mr. Shimkin says, okay, Renata, give me the name of where I can reach Duke, because I think this is really terrific. You really have something. He's led a very, very interesting life. So at that time, Duke Ellington owned a beautiful, this is another landmark, a mansion at 333 Riverside Drive in Manhattan, and a managerial staff was hired, I think, to arrange his booking engagements, but mainly to keep people away from Mr. Ellington. His fame was so great at the time that people would just try to go to one of his concerts just to be able to be in his presence or to shake hands with him, which was almost impossible. So Mr. Shimkin, I think the following day, calls me, because offices were in Rockefeller Center. He said, Renata, I can't get through. I've called those offices at 333 Riverside Drive. No one will take my call. And at that time, Burke, I think, is Mr. Shimkin came through as a very, very rich publisher who was probably trying to make some money on Ellington, because Ellington had played at the White House. He was appearing on television and the David Frost Show, giving his sacred concerts. And as I said, it was just maybe they're after to make millions of dollars. And no way could he get through. So Mr. Shimkin said, can you call Billy Taylor? Because he knew Billy Taylor was on very good terms with Mr. Ellington. I said, yes, I'll do that. And I went a step further. I called the Ellington manager myself, and I was absolutely grilled by a receptionist. She, you know, what is the reason of the call? I said, to offer Mr. Ellington unlimited book proposals. I'm only an editorial assistant. I said, I want you to know what Simon & Schuster, they've just published a beautiful children's reading program with beautiful posters and film strips and textbooks portraying children of all races and all backgrounds. I said, because the publishers of Simon & Schuster are intent of trying to stop the violence that's been going on in these race riots and the terrible unrest, want to help bring little black children especially into an integrated and beautiful racially harmonious society. And that's what just broke this lady's heart, that she put me through. And that was the rest. And if people hear my dialogue, it's like Duke is a king. He can publish like absolutely anything he wants, complete memoirs, a small reminiscence, philosophy, sociology. It's absolutely anything. It's already accepted because I just think so much of him. I want Mr. Ellington to know how much I think of him. And at that time, the voice at the other end of the phone, his name was Mr. Martin Hanafy. He was Duke's administrative assistant, who apparently was a heartbeat away from Ellington. And his reply was, I'm going to give all of this information to Mr. Ellington. He was under contract at that time to write, it's a semi-autobiography called Music is My Mistress, which is not a complete memoir, because Mr. Ellington was somewhat superstitious. Actually, the Music is My Mistress contains vignettes, descriptions of people that he worked with throughout his life, and he talks a little bit about growing up in the nation's capital and the wonderful influence that black musicians had on his life, and especially his mother. So anyway, I call it Duke Ellington's 71st birthday gift for all eternity, because I feel that this gesture on my part was done so sincerely that these gifts are still with him. And I offered to send Mr. Ellington and his sister Ruth. This is a lovely, lovely sister. Ruth was 15 years younger than Ellington. Beautiful, beautiful gifts, the posters of the Multicultural Children's Program. And Mr. Hanafy again melted, yes, go ahead and do that. And a couple hours later, Billy Taylor had been informed of everything, because I called him. And these are Billy Taylor's words. Duke thanks you very much, and he wants to know more about the project. Thank you so much. So Burke, for a young woman that worked in book publishing, I achieved whatever, the president of Simon & Schuster, with all his talent and millions of dollars, couldn't do. And the other thing was this music project, trying to get jazz performed in concert halls. It went on for several years, letters and letters and letters, just on my own, done peacefully, never taking anybody to task, never asking Billy Taylor or any of these people I had met, like Blossom Deary, Bill Evans' manager, Freddie Hubbard, you know, lots of these stars, never asking them for anything. But it was a beautiful letter. Again, it's the writing talent. Any young woman that has a degree in literature, go ahead and go work for book publishers. Develop your editing skills, because it's unbelievable how you can communicate in a very peaceful manner and help change society without going out in the street and throwing rocks and shooting. Anyway, it was a letter they wrote to Columbia Artist Management, which I think today they are just the ultimate in managing stars all over the world, describing my project, saying I want jazz musicians to be invited to play in the top concert halls without having to pay huge rental fees. I enclosed a biographical sketch of Mr. Taylor, because Mr. Taylor was, and until his death, and will be after, the premier representative of jazz, is a very handsome man, a very professorial type of man, very soft-spoken, doesn't use foul language. And I figured, well, if I could get him into these places, then all of his friends would follow after that. It was just sort of like a breakthrough. And I did get this magnificent reply in early March 1972, when I had an apartment at Fort Lee, New Jersey, and I want to emphasize, I was still working in publishing, getting top jobs. So I was never the type to say that I don't want a career, I want to find some very rich person to live off of me, to help support me, or to live off my parents. I have to have a career on my own. It's very, very important to maintain my self-respect and to help women get ahead. And at that time, there weren't laws against harassment, so we were subjected, you know, to absolutely, absolutely anything. So anyway, the letter was so beautifully written to Columbia Artist Management that I got several phone calls unbeknown to me, because I was at work that day, and finally a letter from a Mr. Charles Jones, vice president, the top executive of Columbia Artists for Jazz and Popular Music, asking me to call him and asking me please to arrange a meeting in his office, he said, because the letter was so beautifully written and I was so on target about many things, that he wanted to support my project and probably help arrange a tour for Mr. Taylor. But mainly it was this national project that I had undertaken on behalf of hundreds of jazz musicians throughout the United States that he wanted to, whatever it is, to help support. So that's pretty much what it consists of. There had been, I think, a bombing of Columbia Artist Management. This is 1972, displaying the continual unrest. Maybe there were musicians that felt that they should have signed up with Columbia Artists that weren't given a chance. But so anyway, I had the meeting, and what's so extraordinary is this older white man, I think with a southern accent, the only jazz group. They represented, I think, the Dukes of Dixieland, which I'm not, you know, denigrating their talent, but certainly, where were these great black stars of the golden era of jazz? They were no place. Where was Thelonious Monk? Where was Duke Ellington? Where was Dizzy Gillespie? Where was Billy Taylor? And at Lincoln Center, where were they? They were no place in 1970. It was absolutely shameful. The beauty of the genre, which today, fast forward to the year 2010, they have absolutely everything. There are festivals going on all over, including right now in June. I think it's sort of jazz month, jazz festival month. So anyway, with a meeting with Mr. Jones, he tells me, go back and tell Mr. Taylor, at that time music director for the David Frost Show, very, very busy, very, very busy man, and giving concerts at universities and on television. It was so great for Mr. Taylor at that time as he played, whatever it is. He was director of the orchestra, and because he was on television, he was able to be seen by viewers, like, you know, millions and millions of viewers. But anyway, I forgot the point where I was like, oh, the most important thing is Mr. Jones says, this is the message, not that we want to manage Billy. We can work with his manager. We can arrange a tour. We can help an awful lot of his friends. But tell him, get to the crux of the matter. The jazz musicians need to establish a repertory company similar to a ballet repertory company. For instance, at the American Ballet Theater in New York, that the ballet dancers, the home place is Lincoln Center, but they travel all over the world. They participate in ballet presentations all over the world. He said what they need is a jazz repertory company to be established at Lincoln Center, and then the musicians can travel all over the world and really get the honor and the respect that they deserve. So I thank Mr. Whatever it is, I thank him very much for speaking to me, for giving me all this advice, and I go over to the David Frost Show and can communicate with the secretary, who at that time I think was very fashionable to say, you know, we really don't like white people. We don't want anything from the likes of you, but give me the letter anyway. So I said, you're not going to get the letter because I've been working for Mr. Taylor for so long. He's going to have to hear this in the form of a letter from me, which I did. I wrote him a couple letters. And Burke, not to show off, but what I had, not only with Billy Taylor, that could have been represented by Columbia Artists Management, which probably would have been the first black to do that. There he already was the first black music director of something like the Tonight Show, the David Frost Show, but this man was foreseeing the establishment of the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra and Repertory Company, which Wynton Marsalis did establish in 1985. So to say I had all of these things, a young graduate student who got a job in New York for maybe $100 a week was able to get these things to help create these series, probably worth millions of dollars all over the United States, which helped musicians, even Clark Terry, who was an alumnus of the Duke Ellington Orchestra. So I helped Billy Taylor, I helped dozens and dozens of jazz stars, and I helped Mr. Ellington to be given the magnificent respect that he deserved. And the irony is they had established, I think in 1982, the National Endowment for the Arts. It's a special award. It's a Jazz Master Awards. It's similar to having an actor receive an Oscar. Billy Taylor received this, I think, in 1988. But it was the founder of the NEA who describes Mr. Ellington as a magnificent artist, but the tragedy involved in his career that he was not respected. He does not given the attention in his lifetime that he deserved. And because the award was established in 1982, they cannot give it posthumously. So that's when I said, look what I did. I'm ahead of the ball. I'm ahead of everybody. In 1970, I recognized the genius that Ellington was. Simon & Schuster should be publishing not only memoirs, but the thousands of compositions that were unpublished that were revealed, I think, to the Congressional Black Caucus and later to the Smithsonian, that Mr. Ellington was such a genius, he never stopped composing music in his mind, and they'd never been published. But if you can imagine, if these publishers did not have this blind spot and this discrimination towards the black artists, how much more they could have gotten in 1970. But it's very, I think it's, the audio is very, very uplifting. There's a tremendous audience for this. It turned out to be, it's a beautiful tribute to Billy Taylor, because I recorded this the week of July 12th, just like maybe 10 days before his final birthday on Earth, which was July 24th, 2010. And in it, I just urge people, please go over to the Kennedy Center and buy all of Dr. Taylor's CDs, because he was just a magnificent pianist, in addition to being a lecturer and having received 18 honorary PhDs through his lifetime, in addition to the actual PhD that he earned at the University of Massachusetts. And his concern is, because he was very articulate and professorial, and he had all these programs on television and on National Public Radio, he would be remembered only as a broadcaster. This was revealed in an interview with Michael Wilbon, I think 3 or 4 years ago, that Mr. Taylor was saying, quote, they stole from me, they imitated me, meaning other pianists. I never got the recognition that I deserved. I never was asked to play in Europe. And I think the Europe reference was he was never asked to participate in a State Department sponsored tour. And to be so, it's heartbreaking to think this 85-year-old man did not have anything to really carry on his legacy, which I certainly hope that he does with his wife and his daughter and all of these wonderful people that know him. He wants to be remembered as a pianist. A pianist that directed a trio, a pianist that composed hundreds and hundreds of compositions. So this is what I say in the audio, I urge people to go buy all the CDs, begin listening to them, and never stop. And what is so sad is that he died. He died 5 months after I made the audio, which makes it very, very valuable, because it was a beautiful, beautiful gift to me. And I brought it over to Kevin Struthers, who's head of the jazz program at the Kennedy Center, as I said, July 18th. And I said, this is his 89th birthday gift from me. I had not seen him in many years, but it's something that I wanted to record for the students. It was recorded at the Duke Ellington School of the Arts as a gift to the students to show what a middle-class white woman could do, accomplished so peacefully many, many years ago. And also now I want, like, the whole world to know about it. because, as I said, I accomplish these things very, very peacefully. It brings to life the 1960s, the civil rights movement in the United States, which there was violence, there was tragedy, but there was also great beauty. And it covers 1967 to 1972. So it's rich in African American literature and culture, American history, because African American people are part of us. They really definitely are part of whatever it is, American history. And to urge people, please, to go over to the Smithsonian, the National Museum of American History, and tour the Duke Ellington collection. People go to the archives of the National Museum of American History from all over the world to do research about Ellington, who has been judged an incomparable genius. And at the meantime, it's the Duke Ellington School of Arts, was established in 1974 by Peggy Cooper Kafritz and Mike Malone, and named in honor of Duke Ellington. And every child at that school carries the spirit of Duke Ellington in him. So it was really an honor for Miss Ellen Copley, who is the head of the Ellington Fund, to urge me to write this journal. She said, to have known Billy Taylor so closely and in such a beautiful, beautiful relationship when he was like middle age. He was a big star, but certainly not reach at that time what he reached before he died. Artistic director for jazz at the Kennedy Center, given 18 honorary PhDs, earning his own PhD, teaching at all these universities. And we know with Ellington, it's the thousands of compositions that were found after his death, and musicologists judging him. He is beyond category, anybody in his generation. So it was as if I won the lottery to have these stars, to see something in me and to trust me. And that's why I just want to share it to everyone. As they say, young women especially, go out and have a career. Be independent, become empowered. At the same time, don't let materialism blind you. Do charitable work. If it's helping neglected animals or cats, going around the nursing homes to visiting older people. In this case, it was the civil rights movement, which was a clean slate. There was no end. Going into the slums and helping little children whose parents were so demoralized that they didn't even want to take them to the doctor. Jazz musicians, because they didn't have maybe the wherewithal, they didn't have the connections of Billy Taylor, would probably die of drug overdoses in playing in these third and fourth rate clubs, and unable even to get decent housing. So I've been told by another publicist that it's whatever the audience is, what African American people naturally interested in Duke Ellington and Billy Taylor, music departments throughout the United States, because Billy Taylor helped make jazz recognized as what, you know, an original American art form. African American Studies Department, especially to show young African American students, like those at the University of Maryland, where they can get into their whatever their BMW, the first BMW, and go attend class and go get degrees and everything like that. What the world was like maybe 40 or 45 years ago, maybe they couldn't do those things. So it shows in a very positive way how far we as the United States have gone. And I got a beautiful thank you note from Michelle Obama and President Obama. I sent two copies late October, and they got a beautiful thank you note. I also sent a copy to their mother, Mrs. Robinson, because I know they love jazz, and Barack had been on the advisory council of the Ellington School, and they work closely with them, and they thanked me very, very much. And they've gotten other top reviews, including Mr. David Habersick. He's the curator at the National Museum of American History that oversees the Ellington Collection, and he was very, very impressed because I had written about Duke Ellington before, but now all the more the historic value of this because Billy Taylor had passed away. So
it's an amazing story. It's called With Stars in My Eyes, and Renata de Blase has put it down in an audio book as well as an e-book available at Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and bookstores everywhere. Be sure to pick up a copy of With Stars in My Eyes. 100% of the proceeds go to the Duke Ellington School of Music here in Washington, D.C. I'm Burke Allen. Thank you to Renata de Blase, our guest today, for joining us. And you can visit her online at RenataDeBlase.com, where you can purchase With Stars in My Eyes, her tribute to the late Billy Taylor and Duke Ellington. It's an amazing, empowering story. Thanks for listening. Now, go out and make it a great day.